tortilla chips. I really like tortilla chips.
The way they crunch, the way they dip.
I really like tortilla chips.
Welcome to the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. Here we are at the Hotel Andra in downtown Seattle. Second floor. Come back and see us sometimes. We have a good time up here every week. 2 hours. Chef Terry is wrapping up his trip to Portugal with our pal Charlie of Charlie's Produce. And he and his wife have had 10 days of loveliness over there. Super jealous. But we'll miss him today. In his place,
Loretta Douglas.
Loretta Douglas. My daughter, newly minted mother of twins, Adonis and Athena. And they have joined Hercules as the trio of grandchildren that Jackie and I now quite enjoy. We are here every week. You can buy tickets at hotstovesociety.com to come down and be one of our lovely audience. Today we're a little sparse. We have a few people, I think, that got caught in traffic, didn't show yet, but maybe by the end of the show they'll be here to
wander in.
Exactly. Last week we had Chef Bridget Charters. This week we have Loretta. Loretta is our legal counsel, part owner here of the TD & Co. restaurant group, and we're happy to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
Is it great to be out and have the twins off your lap for a minute?
It is wonderful. This is such a nice vacation.
How do you spend your day now? Just
on the couch.
On the couch.
One twin on either side. Yeah.
One twin on either side, pumps in the middle, and it's just crazy. When I go over there and see your mom, who I don't even know anymore, she spends all of her time on the couch with twins.
Bless her.
Yeah, exactly. You seem very much like the babies just want to be on top of you.
Yeah. They just want to be held, and I'm mostly playing defense for our 2.5-year-old, trying not to...
He doesn't like to whack him. He doesn't quite realize his strength at this point.
We're working on it.
Yeah, I like that. We have some great classes coming up here at the Hot Stove. Chef Annie, who's making breakfast this morning, is our director and has lots of things going on, including Dumpling Fest, which we talked a little bit about last week. That is the 26th, 29th, and 30th of September right here. We also have our Italian Intensive coming up. I think Annie, is that October 11th? I'm not mistaken. October 21st, our Italian intensive. And Chef Stuart Lane, who's the executive chef of Spinace Restaurant up on the Capitol Hill, is going to talk about what he's producing for this. We also have Michaela Tartaglia, from Pasta Casalinga down in the market. She's going to talk about her role in the Italian Food Festival. We do these intensive every once in a while just to kind of dive deeper into a subject than a two-hour class would let us. And it's super fun. We have a good time, and we get to know each other in a little different way. Charlie's Produce, cultivating fresh, getting figgy with it. Is that time? If you go to the market, you see these delicate little figs in pint baskets. And I really feel like people just aren't sure what to do with figs. They're not sure they love them. They're not sure they hate them. They're not sure what the heck to do with them. We're going to talk a little bit about that today. They are just an exotic fruit. I have a fig tree in my backyard.
Has it ever produced?
Of course it has. The birds tend to attack them. As soon as they get close to ripe, the birds want to attack them. We're going to talk about in our second hour with Kiki Araneta. She has written an article about private chefing. I think it's like this mysterious world. And you said that it's not mysterious on TikTok. There's some...
Yeah, it's kind of blown up as this interesting cooking subset on TikTok where you follow a day in the life of private chefs.
And do they just travel the world, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the ones that have gotten really popular, it's their summer in the Hamptons, their family that they chef for decamps to the Hamptons for the summer, and they film their time out there.
We lost our Lola chef to that job a million years ago, maybe 18 years ago, something like that. She took a job with a local Seattleite who had a place in the Hamptons and would go every summer and cook for the
Carlisle
family.
Our Carlisle Palace chef is now private chefing, too.
That's
Desi
right.
is. Yeah. And, I think it's a really interesting kind of evolution of a cooking career. And for some people, the start of it, some people come to it later after they've been on the line for a while. And
yeah. Well, anyway, Kiki wrote an article about it, and we're going to talk about that. Marinating meat from a story in the Washington Post. Which, if you ever listen to our show, you'll know that I'm a big fan of the food sections of a few newspapers around the country. The LA Times, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. All three have terrific food sections. And an old Seattle foodie reviewer, Tom Sietsma, is the big the big deal at the Washington Post. Yeah. And we're going to have our taste of the week. Don't forget, Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia is wrapping up our show. So my taste of the week, I was at the Shoreline Central Market, and they, you know, I go, when you first go in over by the produce side of the store, you go right into the live fish tanks, and the spot prawns were out, and your mother loves spot prawns. And so I bought a couple of pounds, and, you know, when they're live, you have to literally eat them that night, or you have to somehow just take the heads off, and you can keep the tails down, but you can't let them die
in with their head and stuff.
Yeah, because the enzymes from the head and the body start to eat at the tail, and they become very mushy. And so it's something you either freeze them live whole, or you have to just take the head off and save the tail. If you go to some sushi bars around town during this season, they keep a live tank right on the sushi bar, and when you order them, that's when they work the shrimp to put it on a nigiri or however.
When you
it
often
is.
Get the head fried. And
yeah, you get the head. Your mom likes
Abby.
That. Yeah. So you have a taste that you've been talking
about.
Yeah.
Speaking of food sections in newspapers, and my lovely mother, she had us over for dinner the other night and made this recipe from the New York Times, and it was a kalbi teok, which is a rice cake skewer on the grill, and it was delicious. That sweet, chewy, spicy kind of mix. You know, last time I was on the show, I think we talked about rice cakes. It is one of my all-time favorite textures. And I thought they were delicious. And our 2.5-year-olds loved picking up the sticks and gnawing all the food off of them. And
yeah. And that kalbi that she had was a wagyu, so it was really tender and juicy. And we made it spicy, actually. We put the Korean paste on it to spice it up, because kalbi generally is like a sweet teriyaki-ish kind of sauce, and so black soy mirin.
It's one of those pre-marinated meats that you can often find at the grocery store. I buy it as flank steak all the time, but you can get it with bone-in kalbi ribs and things like that. But it was a really interesting new way to use it, I thought.
And those rice cakes, they're a little bit like tofu. They have a better texture. I like the chew, but they taste like whatever you put on them, right?
Yeah.
They are very bland. They don't have any of their own real flavor other than a rice flavor, but they are chewy good. It's like eating fresh bubblegum. What food lovers is going to happen the 21st of October? That is the Italian food lovers right here at the Hot Stove. Festa d'Autunno, which is the autumn festival in Italy.
Can't wait.
We're doing a few days. Hey, Annie, how many days are we doing of the Festa Italiano? Full day, a Saturday full day, 9 to 6 p.m., if you want a ticket to join us, they're at hotstovesociety.com. But so much more show coming up with Stuart Lane from Spinace Restaurant on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM.
Sugar, I remember sugar. Not much of a look.
A bottle of red, a bottle of white. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant.
Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo. I'm joined by my daughter, Loretta Douglas. She's sitting in for Chef Terry. How's your French accent?
Terrible.
You know, he learned his in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So
okay.
Yeah. So maybe you should go to Sheboygan and you'll come back with a French accent.
Come back French. I can't wait. Okay.
Stuart Lane is here from Spinace Restaurant. He's on Zoom, and we're going to talk a little bit about Festa d'Autunno, which is the autumn festival here at the Hot Stove on the 21st of October. It's all day long. It's a good event. It's a little pricey, but the amount of taste and enjoyment you're going to get is well worth it. We're going to spend the entire day on the 21st. I'm the MC, Stuart,
wow.
So just so you know, I've got stories on you, buddy.
He's going to back out now. Suddenly ill.
I can take it.
Stuart, you are a fairly new father. You are, I believe, part owner of Spinace now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, I own a little bit.
And Artuzzi.
And you are joining us here this morning after a busy night last night. Tell us about what you're going to be doing with Chef Annie here at the Festa d'Italiano?
Well, we're going to do a few things. One, I guess like the star of the show would be the pancetta ripiena that we do. It's kind of like a little bit like a roasted pork belly. So it's a big pork belly that we, you know, open up, like book fold it basically like this, and then make a puree of prosciutto, the Parma, and herbs and a little bit of onions and garlic and stuff, and basically spread it on that pork belly. Wow. And then we roll it up,
just a light meal.
And then we kind of cook it in an interesting way. I don't know. So that's like the star. That's our pancetta ripiena.
What makes it interesting? We'll be the deciders on that.
Well, I was like, do I say all this stuff? Is it going to be like, okay, he just told us everything, so we're done. But I can just say it. So it's like, the thing is that, you know, the conundrum with it, as you guys know, is like the restaurant pickup, right? Like you make this thing. If you were doing a pancetta for a group of people, or we were cooking for like 20 people and that was it, just like one dinner, then you could just roast it whole and be fine with that, right? And let it rest and then slice it. But in, or, you know, like let it like get really brown and like you're fine. But in a restaurant, you have to have portions. And so the portions, you don't want to dry out, you don't want to get weird. So we're trying to think like, how do we make this thing that when it's done, it's like this big and this big, it's huge, right? Uh-huh. And so the way we did it, which I really like the technique, instead of trying to like get a giant pan or a brazier and like trying to like brown it evenly as like one giant thing, because it would tear up the raw fat and all that stuff. So what we did is we basically caramelized some vegetables, you know, deglazed with white wine, our brodo, which is made with like duck bones and prosciutto and Parmesan, all that. And we put that in a pan in a low oven and then put the pancetta just raw in that pan. And then over the course of like 4 or 5 hours, I can't remember, you know, however long it takes, because they do vary a little bit. Every like half an hour, we basically turn it just a little bit, like turn them all, just like slowly turn them. And as it does it, it's like the brodo covers the top of the pancetta and then kind of glazes, right? Because then it bakes on a little bit.
Because it's dehydrating while you're doing that, right?
And it browns and glazes and then solidifies. And you just keep doing that. So when it's done, it has this beautiful, like, brown kind of, like, caramelized look. But you never seared it. And so it's much more gentle. Mm. And it makes it more even cooked, too. So it's just a nice little technique. I don't really see people do that or hear people do that. But I think it's, like, a great, great move.
So on so a pancetta like that, a pancetta is literally a pork belly. You know, we think of it here in the States as bacon. It's the same cut. How do you get it so that you render some of that fat out of there, so you're not just eating a plate of, you know, because when you cook bacon, obviously, you're, you know, most people take it to crisp and you're rendering that fat. And so how does that work?
It depends on the belly itself, because sometimes you get these like heritage breeds, or you get a certain cut and it's like really fatty, right? Like,
right.
like the fat cap will be like this big, you know? And so then with that, rather than go through the effort of like trying to figure out how to render it, I would probably just butcher that down, like literally just trim off some of the fat. So it takes a lot of the work out of it for me. Uh-huh. And then with that technique I just said, because it takes so many hours at that temperature, it's basically slowly rendering. So you're kind of okay in that way. Mm-hmm. But I would say most of the time it's just like a physical move of just taking the fat off. I mean, make your life easier and then just save that fat, render that fat, and then use that to make like biscuits or something, like, you know, like later.
So are you curing your own pancetta, or do you just buy a whole pancetta?
We buy them whole. We try to get the best that we can. Right now we're using Preservation Meat Collective. So they're kind of fun. Do you guys work with them?
We have a little bit, not a lot, mostly on specialty items.
Yeah. I think you guys are so big too. Like, they're not as big a company, so I don't know if they could handle your volume that you need. But like for us, cause we're smaller, you know, they're going out and getting like local farmers and local producers, and so it's kind of nice for us to like try to get that. Like, we use Nikki Preservation Meat Collective, a little bit Corfini, but mostly PMC, I would say.
All right, what else are you making on the 21st of October?
I'm also doing our cipollini. So I'm doing all these like stuffed things, I guess. So we're doing these like our cipollini appetizer, which I don't know, have you ever had that?
I think I have. You know, whenever I see cipollini on a menu, I'm just impressed. They're such a pain in the butt to prep.
Oh my god!
I'm so impressed that somebody's taken the time to do it for me, that I always order them.
Yeah,
it's an Italian style onion, a little flat onion.
I mean, it's tricky because the one side, like the running a restaurant side, is this is not, this is a bad decision. You know, you are making a poor decision. And so there's that, but they're so good. And so we just have to do them. We just do it. We do it every year when it gets cold. And we just bite the bullet, and we just know our lives are going to be difficult, and we just do it.
Well, you know, not only that, but they're expensive, too. And when you look at the waste on them and stuff, it's just a labor and food
they're
cost.
They're so sweet and delicious.
Yeah, they're good, though.
What we tried to do is, like, we, you know, we roast them just whole for, like, 10 or 15 minutes. Like, it's really fast. And then we, all the scrap that we use from taking them out, we basically make a sweet onion broth with that scrap. And then pick up the onion dish in that to avoid waste.
Yeah.
So that kind of helps with a little bit with that. But there's no getting around. They just take freaking forever.
Yeah.
I mean, they're crazy.
They're so good. I roast them every year for Thanksgiving. And I do just a dry roast with saba, which is like a unoaked balsamic, is what I would kind of call it. Sweet, a little bit vinegar. But yeah. I just love them just kind of pan roasted too. So.
Well, it'll be super fun to have you at Festa di Atuno. I'm hoping I get to escape the children and come hang out.
If you want to join Stuart and us and a few other fine folks from around Seattle, including Michaela from Casa Lingua, you can just go to hotstovesociety.com, get a ticket, and come see Stu. Stuart was at Cuoco, and he achieved the highest honor of being called Stu Meat.
Which I don't think
he's ever forgiven me for.
No.
Thank you, Stuart.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It was great. And I'm looking forward to that day. And I don't know like how that day is going to go, but I would love to like see the other Italian. Like I want Italian restaurants and chefs to do well. And so it's always fun to see what other people are doing and what other regions, how they're doing things. It's like, I just love Italian cuisine. So it's fantastic.
Thank you so much.
See you there.
See you on the 21st. Up next, it's our segment, our first in a slew of segments called Chinese Menu with Grace Lin and her new book of the same name, The History, the Myths, and the Legends Behind Your Favorite American Chinese Food. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo. I get all the books from all the authors and the publicists from around the country, and then I love them all, but this one particularly caught my attention because of my love for American Chinese food. It's kind of where I first was enamored with the restaurant business, is going into a Chinese restaurant and having sweet and sour pork and spring rolls or egg rolls with my father. Way back when on the Garden State Parkway. So when I got Grace's book, I just said, this is more to me than just a 10-minute interview here on the show. So I sat with her last week. We did 7 segments, went all the way through her book, and today we're going to get started on segment number 1. If you are out there looking for it, it's being released right now. It's called Chinese Menu, The History, Myths, and Legends Behind Your Favorite American Chinese Foods. Let's listen.
The part I loved about this right from the very beginning was the menu. And some of you know on this show that one of the ways I got introduced to this kind of American Chinese food that I've fallen in love with over the years is driving with my father on one of his sales routes. He was a traveling salesman, left Monday mornings, came back Friday nights. And one time that I can remember, I went on his business trip with him. I was about 10 years old, and we stopped at a diner on the Garden State Parkway. And I had my first Chinese spring rolls, and I had my first sweet and sour pork, and my father stopped at this particular diner every time he drove up the Garden State Parkway. And I have been enamored with the Chinese menu and Chinese food ever since. So there's a new book out. It's, like I said, it's called Chinese Menu. It's by Grace Lin, a Newbery and Caldecott Honor Award winner. She happens to share a publicist that I am familiar with, who was on my book Seattle Kitchen some 25 years ago out of William Morrow. And so we're going to welcome to our show Grace. Hi, Grace.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And Grace, I have asked you to kind of extend your time with us today. I'm doing these interviews kind of separately from the show. We're going to pop them in. And there's so much cool stuff that I wanted to cover in this book because it's a fascinating subject to me. So we're going to make this a 7-part series on Grace's book and talk about the history, myths, and legends of what we know of as Chinese food in America. So thank you for sharing your time and your thoughts and your own personal passion with us here at the Hot Stove.
Yay, I'm really glad to be here.
Awesome. Okay, so let's start. Your book is called Chinese Menus. Let's start with that, because I'm always amazed as a chef and restaurateur how freaky large Chinese menus are. And if you break it down, when you look, you see that it's basically the same. There's broccoli beef, broccoli chicken, broccoli shrimp, you know, basically a lot of the crossover. But how should we approach a Chinese menu when you walk into a Chinese restaurant here in the States?
I mean, there's two ways you can approach it. One is you pick your favorite foods, obviously. But my book asks you to approach the Chinese menu just a little bit different. And my book asks you to approach the Chinese menu as almost a story feast, to look at the names of these dishes that you order probably all the time and think about where these dishes came from, the stories and the roots of these dishes. And the book that I created tells the stories, and they're absolutely fascinating, I think. And I think anybody who eats Chinese food will be fascinated by them too.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some crazy things like General Chow sells chicken, and there's yes. like Buddha's Trail. And, you know, so there are amazing little stories that kind of pique your interest about historically where these dishes came from. And your book is broken down into chapters, kind of talking about some of the major items that are in the Chinese menu. So we're going to start at the beginning. And like I said, this is going to be a 7-part series, and we're going to continue to work through Grace's book and tackle some of the more interesting areas, at least the areas that I find interesting about the food. So your book leads off with a chapter on tea, and there's all sorts of interesting concepts around the tea, whether it is a delicious beverage. Like we think of beverages, does it match up with the food? Is it just really because you're thirsty? You know, are the teas from the same region as the dishes maybe came from? So tell us about tea and why it's important. And basically, you get it in every Chinese restaurant.
Yes, tea is extremely important in Chinese culture. Strangely enough, though, traditional Chinese cuisine did not have any beverage with it. They considered the soup to be the beverage. And so it's only here in the United States that they started serving tea with the food. The tea was actually like a completely separate, I wouldn't say maybe a course. It was like people went to tea houses just for tea. It was like tea was like a separate meal almost, you know. But it's been a very, very important part of Chinese cuisine. Tea, they almost have... It's almost religious the way it was in ancient China. There's a big ritual with tea, from the way that you pour it to the way that you brew it, to the way they collected the water. At one point in ancient China, they would collect the morning dew just to make tea out of them.
Isn't that crazy? And so is it more British in nature the way the Chinese look at it, where it is a afternoon ritual with comes with some cookies or some pastries, or is it just about the leaves and the tea?
I would say that it's more about the leaves and the tea, but there is dim sum. Dim sum is probably, I have not done the research, but now that you bring up English tea, I was thinking about it. And I bet you that dim sum, which is when they serve little mm-hmm. bits of food with the tea, probably was similar to the British tea. Like that, maybe that's an offshoot from there.
Right.
That tradition.
And is there an etiquette with tea? Like as you sometimes with wine, you always pour wine for the person next to you, or is there an etiquette that comes with tea service?
Oh, yes. There's a definite etiquette. There's just you're having tea with friends versus like the whole like ritual of tea, like during marriage ceremonies, things like that. But if you're just having tea with friends, it's very important that the host serves the tea and then the host serves to the oldest person first and it goes around to the youngest person last and then themselves. And so it's and you usually serve it with two hands. It's like you're serving it as a gift.
So you pour it and then hand the cup with two hands.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So it's like almost like Japanese sake traditions or etiquette where you always kind of pour for the elder first.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
All right, let's jump into Chinese food in general. So you often hear when ethnic food comes up, you know, well, there's actually Asians eating in that restaurant. It must be good. You know what I'm saying? So like there's this idea of American Chinese food and Chinese food. Is the American version inferior? Is it just watered down? Is it a melting pot? What tell us about the difference?
This is the whole reason why I created this book, Chinese Menu, because when I researched, back in 2004, I did a book called Fortune Cookie Fortunes, which was a picture book, a book for kindergartners and first graders about fortune cookies. And that is when I found out that the fortune cookie is a completely Asian American invention. And when I told this to people, people would get kind of disgusted. And they'd say like, oh, so the fortune cookie's not even really Chinese. And that would really bother me because, you know, I'm Asian. I was born here in the United States, but I had a very tenuous relationship with my Asian heritage. And so I could easily hear people say the same thing about me, like, oh, she's not really Chinese. And that completely bothered me because I felt like, you know, there is nothing wrong with being Asian American. In fact, I think that's something to be very proud of and something actually quite wonderful. And so I kind of felt this kinship with this fortune cookie. And I kind of felt like we should give the fortune cookie much more respect because it's amazing. It's an Asian food that was created in the United States. It's the first, like one of the first Asian American foods. And I wanted to do this book, Chinese Menu, to kind of give this food, this American food that has roots in China, more respect, with the idea that hopefully if we give this American food that has Asian roots more respect, we might give our fellow Americans who also have Asian roots more respect as well.
Oh, what an interesting concept that is. Yeah.
Yeah. So is one inferior to the other? I don't believe so. I believe they're just different. And I actually feel that, though I do think that there is a, I don't want to say a myth, there's definitely a prejudice against American Chinese food. I think that there's a prejudice thinking that it is inferior, but that is a prejudice I would like to change with all this right. book.
We've been talking with Grace Lin. She is the author of a new book called Chinese Menu, The History, Myths, and Legends Behind Your Favorite Foods. And there's so much to talk about here. We're going to make this a series on the Hot Stove Show. So next week, we're going to jump into, do you eat appetizers at a Chinese restaurant? Is there a tip of the cap to the Western course tradition by doing that? So lots of different things to talk about when it comes to the Chinese menu. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM.
So I went out on the street
where
I was sure that I could find
a nice
little bar and something to eat. Then I saw a Chinese restaurant and ordered Hong Kong chicken with tea
and followed that with a fortune cookie for me.
I love figs, you love figs, we love figs, 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 figs.
We're back here in the Hot Stove Kitchens in downtown Seattle. Thank you for joining us today. I think some people who bought tickets got stuck in traffic because they didn't show. We get to eat their breakfast.
They heard that I was here and Terry wasn't. So
the traffic was bad.
Yeah.
We're coming back to our Charlie's Produce Cultivating Fresh segment. We do it every week, and this week we're getting figgy with it. It's that time when you're going into the Met Market or the Shoreline Central or places around town where you see these beautiful little pint boxes of figs, and you just look at them. And I think some people are a bit intimidated. They're a very earthy flavor, the figs, And they're only around for a short time of the year, so people aren't as familiar with figs as they might be raspberries or blueberries. To no avail. You should be out there. You should be trying them. There's so many good fig tart recipes online. Check out some figs. Our Charlie's friends are here, John and PJ, John Janker and PJ Crawley. Let's talk figs. Who wants to get started here? Tell us about what you brought today.
Well, I think I'll start off, and I think you hit it right on the noggin. The way I looked at it here a couple weeks ago, I was going through some of the trade magazines that we typically get and look through. I tend to spend a few minutes every day kind of looking through what's going on and what people are promoting. Came across an article about figs, and the season was starting. So that intrigued me, actually, because I'm a little embarrassed to say this. I have never eaten a fresh fig before. Certainly have had figs and fig
You're noodles. A grown man, and you never had a fresh fig before.
And 50 years in the produce business, it's...
Because they're intimidating. They're a little intimidating.
And, yeah, exactly. So I did a little research. I jumped into our system to understand what we actually do with figs, and I was actually pleasantly surprised to understand we sell a lot of figs with very little effort, quite honestly. So I thought it was important because we're always trying to do the best things for our customers to stay ahead of the trends, bring unique items to them, and support our growers. So what we did here, just a couple weeks ago, we grabbed a few of our sales guys, people from the Met Market, our marketing team, and we went down to California to meet up with some of our growers down there and learn a little bit more about figs. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is make this is a perfect segment to talk about. Thought we would bring that to light because ultimately what we're trying to do is make sure more people are eating figs and understand what they're about.
Right. And a lot of people eat them dried, and we actually rehydrate the dry, or we'll puree the dry with fresh olives, or there are all sorts of savory items to go along with it. But when you're traveling through Europe, like many people have this summer, you see figs in every market, in every dessert shop, bakery. PJ, how do you like figs? Don't tell me you haven't eaten them either.
I was probably in my 20s before I ever had a fresh fig. They weren't around when I was growing up. I was exposed to them at a retail level, and I've been a fan ever since. I don't like every single variety necessarily, but we have some that are pretty special. They've got lots of different uses. I'd like to run down, over the course of the year, we have 10 varieties or so we go through. The Black Mission is the most common variety.
You see those a lot. And when they get nice and soft, they are just perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah. Brown Turkey Fig, Codota Fig, Calmerna Fig, Excel Fig, Cal Sierra, Tiger Stripe, Candy Stripe, and Adriatic. And the first two are dark color. The rest are green ones. And almost all of them, they've got a lot of great culinary uses. They can be dried, eaten fresh. The last two, the Candy Stripe and the Adriatic, my mind are kind of the crown jewel of the fig world. And maybe take this as a challenge, Tom, but the Adriatic fig, very much like a true tree-ripe peach. I don't think there's anything you can do to it to improve upon what it tastes like coming off the tree. I mean, it tastes like it's full of raspberry jam with a nice little green wrapper on it. They're pretty magical just as they are at it.
Absolutely. And when you can get them before the birds get them, because the birds, they're indiscriminate, I will say. They love them, and they like a bite of every one. They don't necessarily like to finish them once they bite into them. So if you can get them before the birds... You're right. Those figs, just like a good fresh peach off of a warm orchard tree, just drip with sugar. It's like simple syrup coming out of the center of them.
Very true.
Loretta, you love figs. You've been eating them in my house or our house
forever.
You have a favorite way to have them? Other than with, I know you love anything fruit-wise with prosciutto.
Yes, of course. No, I think like PJ's, like a perfect fig is a perfect food. I think there's a reason they're called the food of the gods. And with prosciutto, in the off season, I love that fig jam on a cheese plate. But yeah, in season, I don't really think that you need to do much to them. I like them roasted occasionally too. They don't need to be sweeter, but roasting them does kind of really caramelize that sugar. I think they're great with a more savory accompaniment when they're roasted like
any
that.
Any sort of charcuterie or salty cheese, because of their sweetness level and earthiness, you can put them with spicy Coca-Cola, duck liver mousse, with a fresh fig on top. I mean, it's just a million ways to enjoy them. as a fresh product.
Yeah.
You know, I agree. I mean, we have a lot of, when I looked into our research and see who we were actually selling figs to, food service is a very big segment of our business.
Uh-huh.
Figs, I'd say probably 60, 70% of our fig sales are going to our food service customers. Pizzas, salads, all kinds of stuff. So what we're trying to do with all of this is get that excitement back out there, because as I asked others in around our company, some of our customers, people I know, much like myself, many of them never had a fig or understood what they taste like or how to even eat them. They are very intimidating. They're very delicate. You know, with some of those things we learned when we were down in California working with our growers was, you know, how hard is it to ship the right ripeness of fruit to get that best eating experience.
I bet they go over quick. I mean, quickly, like
very short shelf life, and you know, so you can imagine these California growers of ours are shipping them all the way to the East Coast. So they got to figure out how to pick a fig, what ripeness they're going to be able to make that transit. We're fortunate on the West Coast; we're about 2 days closer than we are they are on the East Coast. You know, so then they have to have a riper fig to get to us so our customers have that great eating experience.
Probably worth mentioning also that our fig growers in California were some of the first to embrace organic practices, and it's one of the very few commodities where the majority of the figs we sell are organic versus conventional. Most commodities, it's a, you know, heavier towards conventional,
right,
and lesser on organic. Stellar and Maywood Farms are two of our preferred vendors down there. Bob Steinacker has been growing at Maywood for years and years now and is probably getting pretty close to retirement. But when you see these Maywood figs out in the marketplace, know that, you know, there might be people in this world that are growing figs as good as what Bob is growing there, but I don't think there's anyone growing a better fig than Bob Steinacker grows at Maywood.
Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, across all those varieties we discuss. So, you know, look for that at the store, look for that at the restaurants. They're figs were never a fruit I was exposed to or knew a lot about, but it's a pretty special item.
One of my favorite recipes that I did, it's in my book, Tom's Big Dinners. It was for Dale Chihuly's chapter. And in that book, I did a quickly poached fresh fig, which if they're ripe, when I say quickly, I mean we're talking 10 seconds, because if you poach them longer, they'll disappear. But I did it with a Moscato Jello, which I called glass, and I just made a big pile of gelatin with the Moscato wine and cut it in shards, and it looked like glass for his chapter. And boy, the figs, the, you know, the earthy figs with the sweet Moscato gelatin, it's really a nice combination. If you've never tried cooking with figs, this is the year. Force yourself to buy a pint. They're not cheap. It's probably $7 or $8 investment, but it's really fun to explore with them and make a fresh fig tart. Use them on a cheese platter. There's all sorts of ways to be successful with figs.
I think they feel fancy. They feel different. For me, having eaten them my whole life, they feel like a sign of the season. And yeah, a perfect fig is a perfect food. Yeah.
What are some of the stores that we can find your figs in?
Certainly in the metropolitan markets. They are promoting them very heavily. You'll find them in your local independent retailers up and down the West Coast.
Okay. And if you want to follow a Charlie's truck to one of our joints, you can probably find them in one of our restaurants.
Absolutely.
On Cairo Radio, that's Cultivating Fresh with Charlie's Produce. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM.
A little tomato, agitator. Shook the shimmy with the sweet potato and old man garlic.
Everybody singing in the kitchen, banging on pots and pans. A mommy and daddy singing in the kitchen. Baby laughing, singing in the kitchen. All the kids singing in the kitchen.
Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. We're happy that you're here. We're coming to you from the beautiful Hotel Andra in downtown Seattle, from the kitchen studios of the Hot Stove Society. We have a full hour to go here, including Casalingua's Michaela Tartaglia. She's going to talk about her role in the upcoming Italian Food Festival on the 21st of October here at the Hot Stove. A story from the Washington Post about marinating meat, which I have some real opinions on. We're going to finish the show with Rub With Love Food for Thought Tasty Trivia, and we're going to jump right now into food in the news. And normally I have a few segments of this, but today we're going to focus just on a story that I read by Kiki Araneta. She has wrote a story about private chefing. And since we've lost some of our favorite chefs to the private chefing world, I was curious of Kiki's thoughts about the life of a private chef. Welcome to the show, Kiki.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So you wrote your article in Food and Wine, and I emailed you immediately asking if you would come on our show and talk about the article, because as you heard me say, we've lost a few chefs to private chefing, but it's just such a crazy thing to go, in my mind, to go live with somebody maybe, or be at somebody's house 7 days a week, know their kids, know their family, know their vacation schedules. It's just such an interesting change of pace than the restaurant business.
So it's not really like that. It's not 7 days. It's never 7 days a week. No client that I've ever worked for. And I'm a restaurant chef by trade and training. I had my own restaurant, which I closed during the pandemic. So I was a very reluctant person to get into private chefing initially. Like, I was approached by an agent who specifically wanted somebody to cook like Hawaiian style poke bowls, and I specialize in fresh fish for one of her high profile clients. So, and I tried to pass it off. Like, I tried to find her somebody else that I felt was more appropriate for private chefing. And once it became clear that I really was the right person, I took it on. I partnered with one of my friends who is an excellent cook. That said, it's never 7 days a week. It's never like living in somebody's house. Like, sometimes you're provided with a place to stay. I know in the pandemic, certain chefs ended up staying in clients' houses maybe a bit more often than what normally happens. You're never on 7 days a week.
What do you do when you...
Like, I don't know any client who would ever ask that of me or anybody else. Like, maximum you're on 5 days.
So when they go on vacation, don't you go with them? Or how does all that work?
I typically cook for people who have multiple houses, and they go from place to place. They often work with a chef agent who will find them somebody local.
Oh, I see.
So let's say one family spends several months in Greece every year. They're going to find, like, sometimes it's with my help. We'll find somebody local who knows the markets and so on and so forth. Nice. I will travel for certain gigs, but private chefing for me it's like a side hustle that's very lucrative. It's not at all like one of the main things I do.
So I am one of the people that loves watching private chef TikTok. And mm-hmm. your article talks kind of about that, and about, you know, the difference in the 3 minutes that you might see of a video on TikTok that looks super glamorous versus what actually goes into it. Can you talk a little bit more about how maybe the rise of private chefs on TikTok has changed people's perception of the business? And
I think it's been really, really good for private chefs who typically don't have like such a large platform. The reality is we are working with the absolute best ingredients you could possibly get your hands on. I often work with no budget, get the best stuff, the absolutely like best stuff you can get. And I'm very fortunate to have come from a restaurant background. So I have a lot more wholesale and farmer contacts than somebody who's only been in private chefing. They're typically paying retail prices. But yeah, we're working with the absolute best stuff. Sometimes we're working with stuff that was grown on the client's own property. Like, it's just the way that you would see on TikTok. That part is absolutely accurate. But it really, the way that Rebecca King, who I interviewed for that article, described it, you're funneling down like 17 hours of grueling work into a 1 minute video. Something that I find really, really fascinating about the rise of like the TikTok private chef is that I don't record anything when I'm cooking for a client. I'm amazed that they got to that level of trust with their clients to be able to do that. But that's something that I would never do.
Yeah. I was wondering about that because it's a completely separate, almost second job to the private chefing, is all the vlogging and recording yourself and editing and things like that. And you're obviously in private chef world, I imagine, in people's actual homes. I'm surprised by the amount of clients that are okay with that being shown and things like that.
I mean, you're shown a very small sliver. And from what I understand of those chefs that have gotten really big on TikTok, they have permission from their clients. Like, I personally would never ask that of a client. And also, like, I'm lazy when it comes to social media. Like, it's so much work. And also, like, I'm not looking cute when I'm in the kitchen. You know, like, I'm like focusing on like making the food look cute. Like, I can't focus on making the food and me look cute at the same time. It's like, for me, it's like physically impossible. I find it really admirable that there are people able to make these gorgeous, gorgeous videos out of like seriously a very lonely and solitary profession. Yeah. I mean, overall, I think it's a really good thing for the private chef industry. I think at some point it is going to get oversaturated. I don't know. I have a lot of feelings that I can see like where this is going to go in the future. Like, I feel like the market can definitely get oversaturated. I feel like people can watch these videos and think like, oh, I can do that, and immediately try to go into private chefing, and they're never going to have the same experience as like a restaurant chef. Right. But I also feel like that's my own bias coming in.
Kiki, I have to cut you off there because we have to go to a break. But if you want to know more about Kiki's time and read her article in Food and Wine, check out the magazine. Kiki Araneta has been our guest. She's a lovely writer, and it was interesting to me having lost a few of our chefs to private chefing. Thank you, Kiki.
Thank you. Good luck.
All right. Up next, Michaela is here to talk about what she's going to do for Festa Italiano here at the Hot Stove Society on Cabra Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society show.
Goes with everything, cause it's made from swine. It's like your taste fine.
Spaghetti, orecchietti, pontaletti, and linguine. Some capelli, orinelli, vermicelli, farfalline. Rigatoni, macaroni, cannelloni, and stellini. Pappardelle, a rotelli.
We are back in the Hot Stove Kitchen on Cairo Radio. We have a quiet audience today because half the folks didn't show up. I think traffic got them. But we did find a person here who's been slept overnight in the lobby because she showed up for the show yesterday here at the Hot Stove Society radio show. And it is this morning as you have returned.
Yeah, it's better to be early than late.
Yes, exactly. Michaela Tartaglia is the owner and chef of Pasta Casalinga. And she is going to be here along with the rest of us on October 21st for Festa Italiano. How do you say autunno?
Autunno, that's correct.
Autunno, yeah. Festival of the autumn.
Festa Italiana.
Yeah, that's what I said.
No, I said Italiano. Female. Feminine.
So Festival of the Fall, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's your favorite season of Italian cooking? Because you wrote a book. You have a new book out.
Yeah.
Called?
A Pasta for All Seasons. Mm-hmm. Talking about seasonality. Yeah. Yeah, probably the fall.
The fall?
Yeah.
Why? What's that one ingredient? We just had figs, but what's the one ingredient that says fall to you?
Mushrooms, without mushrooms, any doubts, and all the squash family. So, and the greens.
The grave misfortune of being married to somebody that does not like mushrooms at all, and I never get to cook with them. And so I have to order them all fall anytime we're out because...
Well, you've got all your kids now. Can't you just trade them in for a new model?
Yeah, exactly.
So what are some of the things that you're going to cook here? Like I said, you have a new book called Pasta for All Seasons. You have the Casalingua, which is the pasta restaurant down above De Laurentiis there in the little market court.
Yeah, next door. Yeah, pretty much.
You have product in stores. I buy it all the time.
The pasta, the Metropolitan pasta, Market. Yeah, super happy. We're still actually with the new locations of Metropolitan Market, the pasta.
It's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I buy it every time I shop there, which is a couple times a week. So
thank you. Yeah, it's a fun project born during the pandemic and still ongoing. So super happy to have people that cannot come to the market but can still buy the pasta and make it home and maybe using the book to make the recipe. And for that Festa Italiana, we're going to make two fun recipes.
Festa Italiano.
Two fun fall recipes. One is a pumpkin puree, which is lovely. And the other one is the panko.
Chitarra.
Yeah, spaghetti alla chitarra, yeah. Which are going to is going to be fun because we're going to craft the pasta using this beautiful artisanal tool. Mm-hmm. I think
is that the one with the wood on the ends and the wires that
exactly.
go?
Exactly. Okay. It looks like a guitar.
Right.
That's why a chitarra.
Uh-huh.
And we had some cooking classes in the past using that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you just put the sheet of pasta on the guitarra?
Yeah.
And push it through the wires?
You push it through. Yeah, usually the guitarra has one side that is a little bit thicker to make a thicker spaghetti, and the other one a little bit thinner. And then you just, with a rolling pin, uh-huh. you just press it. It's kind of a... I know it's also nice to do and to watch.
Yeah.
So that's going to be fun. Mm. Yeah.
And then is that where you're putting your pumpkin? Your pumpkin puree?
Yes. It's going to look very nice with the pumpkin puree, Nigella seeds, mm-hmm. and I think Bulgarian cheese or feta. We'll see what we have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something like a nice cheese that is a little bit brinier, you know.
And more combined. Crumbly?
Yeah. They will look very nice, very mm-hmm. good. And then it's a good shape that goes well with the sauce.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are no rules in general about, you know, pasta and sauce. Usually people do whatever they like the best, but some are just weird. You know, spaghetti with ragu is just something very strange. We don't really...
Because the ragu is so heavy and the spaghetti is so light. Is that what you're
saying?
Yeah,
and it's the most stereotyped pasta that you see all around the world, mm-hmm. spaghetti with bolognese.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't make any sense for us.
So you like rigatoni with bolognese?
Absolutely.
It's like a heavier noodle.
Yeah, something edgier. So rigatoni, tortiglioni, all of this. But also pappardelle.
Mm-hmm.
So now don't ask me why pappardelle work and spaghetti don't.
Well, it makes sense. It's a big wide noodle.
It is, yeah. But, you know, it's just a certain shapes are just strange.
Mm-hmm. We have an enduring debate in my house because I love shortcut pasta. And my husband,
penne or
mm-hmm. rigatoni. Yeah. I like the thicker, like chewier mouthfeel. And my spouse likes the finer spaghetti, bucatini, the long extruded pasta as often. And I feel very strongly that certain sauces go on shortcut and certain sauces go on long pasta. But it's interesting to hear you say there's no real rules.
Yeah, we tend to do like paccheri, for example. You know, if you like short pasta, you might know paccheri, mm-hmm. the big slap, the yep. small from Naples area. Usually we cook those with seafood and fish. Don't ask me why. Just say,
why?
It's just, but I think that people feel strongly either short pasta or long pasta. It's just two different categories.
Two different camps.
Yeah.
What are you in?
Well, you know, I never get to eat the thin, like cappelletti.
Cappellini.
Or, you know, I know because Jackie doesn't like that.
Okay.
She likes rigatoni, a mm-hmm. heavier, or like fettuccine or linguine.
Yeah.
But I could care less. I like when somebody cooks for me.
Yeah,
which is what happens at Casalinga. They, right? They cook for you.
They do cook for me. They do a fantastic job. Yes. Mm-hmm. We pick, Pasta Casalinga, we pick the shape of pasta with the sauce. You don't come in and say, can I have tagliolini with this? Like, no.
You've chosen.
We love you, but we kind of know a little bit better. So we get followed by us.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. sometimes here and there you find someone like, you know, your husband or say, yeah. I don't like short pasta. And so we said, okay, you know,
fine.
We can make the exception. Or maybe the New Year's, we get this question every year for the beginning of the year. Many want the long pasta
yeah.
for good luck.
Long life.
Yeah.
yeah.
So absolutely, yes. Yeah. Why okay. not? Yeah.
My favorite pasta shape of all time is the orecchiette because mm-hmm. it's a little cup. And it picks up the olive oil and butter, and I use chopped rabe and red chilies and sometimes pancetta or, you know, some Italian mm-hmm. sausage or whatever. I just love how it kind of cups the food
together. Yeah, and
it's called Little Ear, right?
Little Ears, and it's a very. I love all the pastas that they're eggless. So orecchiette is absolutely eggless. Mm-hmm. You know, semolina flour and water from traditionally from Apulia region, the very south of Italy, and it's a simple pasta when you see how they make it. But paradoxically, it's so hard too because you flip with your tongue, and like our days, my mom still cannot make it. Because sometimes if you don't get the technique right, you make the little hole.
Yeah.
Which is...
You either have the touch or you don't. I think it's like folding dumplings or...
It's... And when you see this, like, you know, women, the grandmas, they do so fast and they flip into the cutting board. And also with a knife sometimes, it's just a lot of fun. Yeah.
All this is happening on the 21st. You're
going to
join us.
Yes.
So you're making pasta. Do you remember anything else that you're making?
Casereccia. I'm making I called casereccia in the program, but it will be cicatielli. I taught this class many times here too. Mm-hmm. For those who make the class, I will tell all the story behind the name.
Okay.
And it's a fun pasta. Again, it's a pasta without eggs. You just need your hands to make it, and a butter knife. So no tools required, which make it extra fun.
Yeah.
So everybody can, very accessible, everybody can make it.
Very hands-on.
Yeah, good. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
We can't wait.
Michaela Tartaglia. I have a hard time getting that.
You're perfect, Tom. Yeah. Yes.
Hard time getting that.
One thing right.
Up next, we're going to marinate some meat right here at the Hot Stove Society Kitchen. Do you want to hang with us for another segment?
Why not?
Why not? Because marinating meat is fun.
Yes.
On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM.
Say, woman, what's this stuff you cooking? Now that meat and no potatoes, I just seem right to like a green tomato.
Here I'm waiting, palpitating with all that meat.
And no.
All right, we're back in the Hot Stove Kitchen on Cairo. This is so exciting. Michaela is going to spend another segment with us, and we're going to talk about marinating meat. I was reading a Washington Post article, which is one of my favorite food sections around the country. And I have some pet peeves about marinating meat, mostly when it comes to wine. I think that is a old wives' tale, that marinating meat in wine is kind of a fun, sexy, traditional thing to do. And in my mind, it ruins the meat, unless you're doing it for maybe 15 minutes. But once you leave that wine, you know, wine has a lot of acid in it. Once you leave it on for too long, in my mind, and in my taste buds, the meat starts to get a little bit mealy on the outside when you eat it, and because the wine eats away at the flesh. And so, to me, that's
the
biggest mistake, is when people use citrus or wine to marinate meat for an overly long period. Now, you can use citrus zest, things of that nature, but not the acid and not the juice itself. So, Michaela, since you're sitting here and since you just told us all about pasta, tell us a little bit about Italian traditions when it comes to marinating meat,
you
and
know,
seafood.
Yeah, so actually, just we just mentioned about the wine and marinating meat with wine. I just had this flash of my childhood memories. I think the only time I've seen that happen was my uncle, who is like a hunter, marinated the wild boar with, you know, juniper berries, bay leaves, and red wine.
Classic kind of cacciatore.
Yeah. But marinated overnight for the wild boar. I think that's the only time that we're talking about marinated meat with wine that I can recall. Yeah, we don't usually...
And on larger cuts like that, it's not so much of a problem. It is really what it comes down to is things like a flank steak or, you know, small cuts or chicken breast or shrimp, you know, or when you're marinating seafood. Like, there's a reason why ceviche, the acid cooks the fish, right? I mean, we know that with seafood, that the lime juice or the lemon juice actually cooks the fish. And so that's something you have to be prepared or be worried about when it comes to meat.
Absolutely. And then, you know, one of the most important things we always say when we cook, you know, we make a sauce with meat, like the classic bolognese, for example, or any sort of stew, and we put some wine in it, you know, white or red accordingly. always, and always make sure in the kitchen, please make sure that the wine evaporates completely before you move on and put in the tomato sauce or whatever, because there is nothing more hard for the palate when you taste that alcohol in your sauce. I think it was kind of like a trend from the past, maybe, no? People used to do that more often. So marinating meat, yeah, I think it's pretty similar what we do right here. Depend what, you know, what we do, but citrus, definitely, olive oil, and then spices. So, yeah.
Yeah, Aaron Hutchinson, the author of this article, says marinades generally contain salt, some sort of acid, some sort of fat, typically in the form of oil or olive oil, and aromatics. And the role of marinating is twofold. One is to add flavor, and I think that's what most people should pay attention to, right? Like you said, the juniper berries, the fresh bay leaves are much better than a dried bay leaf, for example. The second thing is to improve the texture of the meat, and so it can have a role in kind of seasoning up the meat. But when you say, how sometimes Thanksgiving people want to brine their turkey or, you know, things like...
For days and days.
Days and days. And it doesn't get better. Mm. Once you achieve where you want to be, where you've seized up the skin a little bit and you've taken some of the moisture out of the skin from the salt in the brine, so now it's going to get crispier when you roast it, you're pretty much there.
Yeah.
Adding an extra day does not help you any.
I really only ever do 15, 20 minutes. It's, you know, I'll throw the meat into something as I start to prep the rest of my dinner and then cook. The only exception for me that I can really think of is if I'm doing something that is going to become the flavor of the food. So if I'm doing a miso black cod, I'll do that, overnight or things like that. So it's really in there. But for me, I find I marinate most when I'm going to cook some kind of Asian food. So Korean, Chinese, stir fry meat, I often will marinate for 20, 30 minutes before I'm going to cook it. I like using baking soda to keep the meat tender. That's something newer that I learned. I think I find
TikTok.
Very effective. I do use the Shaoxing wine a lot, the Chinese wine. Cooking wine. But again, it's really like 20, 30 minutes just to get that flavor in there, keep it tender. But
you know, one of the things that this article also mentions is when you're using acid, that there's three kinds of acid that are generally used. One is vinegar. We know about that, right? One is citric. We talked about lemon, lime. The other, I don't think to mention very often, but is lactic acid. So like when you see Indian food, you often see it marinated in yogurt, and that is another acid. And it's takes a little longer in that process, but it still works beautifully in marinating meat. Are there any Italian things that are marinated in milk or yogurt?
I'm thinking right now.
Because I know like the plin that I make from the Piemontese area, it's braised in milk. The roast pig is braised in milk.
Yeah.
But it's not really marinated in
milk. No, if I think about something like milky, like a dairy, you know, the meat, if we make meatballs, polpette, and we prepare the mixture ahead, which is the best way to make polpette, so it can rest a little bit. You know, often but it's not really marinated. We put the bread with the milk,
and then
we soak the bread with the milk, and then with the parsley, eggs, and everything, we put it together to make the mixture and let it rest. But it's not. I will not call them marinated.
No.
So there is nothing really I can recall with dairy, unless it's something very specific, very regional, or not marination.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Olive oil, lemon, and definitely all the rubs that you can. We use a lot of rosemary and berry, juniper berries, especially if it's a wild, hunted meat.
Yeah, the lactic acid I use the most is when I'm making like a tandoori chicken or tandoori rack of lamb, where you're just adding spices to the yogurt. And,
I love that flavor, though.
And you can use dried yogurt in that scenario, too, which is something you can keep in your cabinet so you don't always have to have. I mean, what do I make it? Once every 6 months?
Yeah.
You don't want to just have yogurt sitting around.
I mean,
my wife feeds it to the
chickens.
I
mean, you eat yogurt regardless, but,
I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
What's wrong?
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's
good for you.
We eat yogurt. One of the caveats that he talks about in this article is that some foods contain enzymes that can impact the texture of meat more broadly, which is something like pineapple juice. Now, I make a Hawaiian style, what I call huli huli chicken, which is huli huli just means turning chicken. You see it on rotisserie carts all around Hawaii. But if you put it on for too long, it'll turn the chicken into mush. You just can't over marinate from the pineapple juice itself. 15 minutes, maybe. Is what he suggests. Hmm. So large cuts of meat, brisket, prime rib, pork shoulder, leg of lamb, turkey, maximum 24 hours, right? Large pieces of meat, like pork tenderloins, pork loins, racks, and butterfly legs of lamb, maybe 6 to 12 hours. And then medium pieces of meat, porterhouse steaks, 4 to 8. And when you get down to chicken breast and, you know, boneless, skinless, this and that, 15 minutes to 2 hours. Michaela, have I ever told you one of the tragedies of my life?
I can't wait to hear this.
I can't wait, yes.
Yeah. One of the tragedies of my life, you know, I'm a chef.
Oh.
And I like to cook things like a whole chicken.
I know where this is going.
This and that. And there's parts of a chicken, as you well know, mm-hmm. that are better than other parts of a chicken. Like a chicken thigh is really moist, has a little bit higher fat content. It's delicious, right? But somehow or another, the tragedy that has hit my life is that my daughter's favorite cut of chicken is boneless, skinless chicken breast. And how this happened, I'll never know. But because I didn't serve them.
Okay, first
it's
of all.
It's not something I ever served. You know where she got it, I think? College. She fell in love with chicken tenders because I didn't serve those either.
Someone cooked
you didn't even serve chicken. You used to say that.
Well, that's because, yeah, life's too short to eat chicken.
Life's too short to eat chicken. And now he eats chicken all the time. So I think it was because I was left to fend for myself on the chicken front. And that is the easiest.
Tell me one redeeming quality of a boneless, skinless chicken breast.
You can do anything with it.
Can play magic. I agree with that.
You must eat tofu.
But, well, no. I love tofu also.
But it's, you know, you can do fun things with that. Come on. You can play around.
Can do anything with it. It's like a blank canvas.
Yeah. I agree.
You agree?
I agree. I'm not, you know, I don't go for number one as my preference, but why not? Come on.
Thank you.
Yes.
So very sad. Thank God Terry's coming back next week.
Hey, what
who
is Terry
also
speaking?
Despises boneless, skinless chicken breast.
So miss him. Yeah.
All right, we're going to wrap up our show with Rub With Love Tasty Trivia when we come back here in the Hot Stove Society Kitchens on Cairo. It's 97.3 FM.
Oh, and chicken wakes up to a new world every day. Far as the chicken's concerned, everything's A-okay. Ah, chicken, don't worry about nothing but clucking and the price of eggs today.
Cornbread and butter beans and you cross the table. Eating them beans and making love as long as I am able. Hoeing corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride the wheel and cut the food.
All right, we're back in the Hot Stove Kitchen on Cairo Radio. We're happy to be wrapping up our show with Food for Thought Tasty Trivia.
Sponsored by the wonderful Rub With Love.
Rub With Love brings deliciousness to your kitchen table with 19 different rubs, a shallot mustard, 3 tasty sauces. You can stock up in stores around the Seattle area and beyond. We're in 5,000 retail locations across the country, including Gardner's Country Meat Market in Portland or Market Meats in Vancouver, British Columbia. They've been a longtime seller of our rubs. Or go to a place on our website, tomdouglas.com, where you can also find tips and recipes and videos and all sorts of fun rub things.
Helpful
all right,
hint.
Let's play. So I'm going to give each of you 5 questions. And then the winner, like I said, gets to go to the gift shop and shop for 3 rubs for free. The loser gets a personal signature of an L on your forehead by me with my trusty Sharpie. Loretta's going to play. We have Lisa and Marilyn on one team here from the audience because they wouldn't come up without each other. And Marcia is going to take us on over here. Marcia, you've been to the show before, have you not?
Quite a long time ago.
You ready, set, Loretta?
Ready as
I'll ever
be.
These women want to take you down.
I need to win that rub.
All right. You get nothing, and you'll be happy about it. A Blenheim orange is what type of fruit? That's a tricky orange. Question right there.
A blood orange?
Yeah, a blenheim orange.
A blenheim orange. It was like a blood orange is in orange, I think. A blenheim orange.
You know, Liz is the one who put this together.
Kill me
she's
here.
A tough cookie.
Yeah. Lemon?
You are incorrect. See, look at that. You're winning already out there, ladies.
Right.
It's an apple.
Oh.
It's an apple. You can thank your pal Liz for that.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks for nothing.
What does aloo mean in Indian cuisine?
Potato?
No, you don't get to answer these. These are her questions. Missy. Potato. Absolutely. Good job. One for two. These are little tricky ones today. What kind of animal is Bombay duck?
Pheasant. I don't know.
I thought you had it for a second because you were forming that F look with your lips. Fish. Not pheasant.
This is not going
Question
well.
Number four. Yeah, you're crashing and burning at the moment. Rye and juniper berries are the constituents of which alcoholic spirit?
Gin,
absolutely. Two for four.
I'll get the boozy question.
Yeah, funny how that is. And then, Loretta, your last question. Make Terry proud here.
Uh-oh.
Okay. What nut is used to make a Bakewell tart?
Almond?
Yes. What is a Bakewell tart? And you sound like you know what it is. I have no idea.
It's like a cakey, I think it's like a cakey, not super sweet almond.
Like an almond tart. Flour type tart. Thing?
Yeah.
I don't know that one. So 3 for 5.
All right.
Nice job. She
Bring
set
it
the
on.
Bar medium.
Medium.
For you.
I set the bar medium.
Okay, Lisa and Marilyn, you got to talk right to the mic when you answer. You can speak amongst yourselves, but when you answer, talk to the mic.
Is it a gimme?
So easy. What is the name of the Mexican dip made from avocados?
Guacamole.
Yes, indeed. You are correct. And the fish roe is used to make what Greek dip? So this is a little bit more difficult, but it's very common in Greek restaurants.
Tzatziki?
No, that's a yogurt dip. You want to try again? Begins with the same letter. Fish roe is used to make which Greek dip? All right, tera masalata. And you'll see that oftentimes in Greek restaurants as a little spread thing. I'm going to put next on that one. There are lots of different flatbreads in the world, but there's a couple of famous ones in Indian cuisine. If you name one of them.
None.
Very good.
What the heck, Liz?
Liz is just jumping. all right, your fourth question. What is the name of the two-colored square cake surrounded by marzipan? I wouldn't know this one either. You love marzipan, Loretta. So, uh-oh, this one. You know, Marcia?
A petit four?
No, but that's a good guess. I like that idea because that's often the case. It's called a Battenberg cake. I've never heard of that before.
You haven't been watching enough Great British Bake Off.
Exactly. All right, you're 50-50 right now, right? You're 2 for 4. This is to tie Loretta Douglas, okay? Which drinks company uses a bat? I'm gonna get rid of this one.
I know that.
Which one is it?
Bacardi.
How do you know that?
I like rum.
I like rum.
Oh my God! I would never have known. They have a bat in their logo. Oh, a bat! I was thinking a baseball bat, but you're talking about the animal bat. You are correct. Good job. 3 for 5.
Whoa,
you've
tied
with Loretta. Now you want to switch your negative energy to Marcia.
This is going to be challenging. All right.
The last Marcia I knew was Marcia Brady.
Oh, that was way long time ago.
Way long time ago. Okay.
And don't say it three times. Yeah.
All right. Are you proficient in baking?
Oh, I do more broiling. I'm baking.
Well, this
go ahead.
Baking.
Give it a try.
Profiteroles are made with which kind of pastry?
Got a hand up.
It's also the name of a dog.
Shoe?
Oh, thank you.
She just gave it to you.
Yeah.
Show paste. Chow chow is what I was thinking of from a dog. So. Sorry, I was trying to give you a clue and I didn't quite make
that
it.
Was it.
But Loretta gave it to you, so you're 1 for 1. All right. What does murgha, MURGHA, mean in Indian cooking? And somebody I know likes it boneless and skinless.
Oh, chicken.
Yes, indeed. There you go. 2 for 2. Pierogi are what type of food?
Guess potatoes.
Potatoes. Well, some pierogi are stuffed with potatoes. Okay. or prunes, but these, or cheese, these are dumplings. Pierogi are dumplings. So that's an X on that one. There is all sorts of chili peppers. Which chili pepper is an essential ingredient in jerk for Caribbean cuisine?
I only know the Thai ones and the...
All right, so it's Scotch bonnet.
Are those Scotch in the Met bonnet. Market?
Yeah, they have them in the Met Market, and they also have my... you know, I worked with Trey Lamont to come out with a jerk for our Rub With Love line, and it's the hottest rub that we sell. And it's got... The other thing I love about that rub is it's got fresh, or not fresh, but powdered bay in it. And I just have never used powdered bay very much in my cooking. And
it's delicious, that rub is hot. It's good.
Yeah, what an elegant herb that is. This one you should get.
Oh.
What cocktail is made from vodka and orange juice?
That should be easy. What is it?
Yes, it should be easy.
I haven't had that forever. I'm just going blank. I've had it all the time.
Yeah.
Mimosas I have more often, but it's okay.
If you, I think if you add grenadine, it's a tequila sunrise, right?
Tequila sunrise.
Grenadine and tequila.
So. I'm going to pass.
Anyway, it's a screwdriver.
Oh, of course. Screwdriver.
Oh, I was thinking grapefruit juice.
Which means, I know, it's like greyhound. She was thinking a greyhound. Yeah. So, you know what? You get a big L on your forehead with a Sharpie, handwritten by me.
All right. That's a treasure.
There you go. It's a treasure. It'll be there a long time. All right. Thank you, Marcia. Thank you, Lisa and Marilyn.
Okay.
Appreciate your efforts here. You guys get to go to the gift shop and grab three rubs at the end of the show. Congratulations.
Thank you.
If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on YouTube Live at Tom Douglas & Co. or buy a ticket to join us in the studio here at thehotstovesociety.com. The show is produced by the Tom Douglas team, Liz and Sean, and our technical wizard at Cairo, Sean DeTore. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of our Hot Stove Society show in Cairo, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe with your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening.